The question is, what is going on in this economy? Your answer in five words or less. Jay Powell, go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 5th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We do a thing every now and then on this program, kind of tongue-in-cheek, kind of serious, trying to get a sense of the state of things. Did it last Friday, in fact.
In five words or less, we're going to an old standby. There's a Fed meeting next week, Wednesday, Thursday. Five words or less, David Gura, what is Jay Powell thinking?
I asked because the Fed was set to meet yesterday and today, as I said.
Stay steady.
Yeah, Gura kind of ran out of gas there. So over I went on the program last Friday to Heather Long.
I think he's thinking, I'm the last man standing, and why?
Oh, man. Seven words technically, so David stepped up.
She can have one of my words. She can have one of my five.
Played you all that to set up this, a special celebrity version of our game show, What is Jay Powell Thinking? In five words or less, today featuring the Fed chair himself.
Expected the pace of improvement.
Word number one, the pace of economic improvement, Mr. Powell says, has slowed since May and June. Okay, moving on.
The further spread of the disease.
The disease, to loosely paraphrase the Fed chair, is the economy. Words numbers three and four.
At least some more fiscal support.
Fiscal support, a relief bill. Which gets us to word number five in our game of What is Jay Powell Thinking, featuring Jay Powell.
Obviously, it's for Congress to decide.
He said. Over to you. As to actual policy news out of the Fed's meeting, by the way, none. Interest rates are going to stay where they are, which is low, low, low for a good long time. And Powell said the Fed is going to do whatever else it can if things get worse. Fun fact, by the way, back when this game was called What is Janet Yellen Thinking?, we called the Fed once to see if she would play, like, for real. They declined. Courteously, though. Okay, I love that game. Come on. All right, let us turn to data. Jobs data specifically. The October unemployment report comes out tomorrow. We learned this morning that 751,000 people lost their jobs last week and filed for unemployment for the first time. And that there are still 8-something months into this thing. 7.3 million people making continuing claims for aid. That is lower than in earlier reports, but still. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
When he sees continuing unemployment claims decline, labor economist David Wixer at Stony Brook University says he would normally infer that people are finding jobs.
The problem in the recent data is that we've had people unemployed for quite a while, and the regular state benefits start to expire.
Each state runs its own unemployment system and determines eligibility and benefit amounts, but no state lets people stay on those benefits for more than 26 weeks. 26 weeks from the start of the shutdown in the middle of March was the middle of September. Andrew Stettner is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation.
If you've been out of work for 6 months, it's hard for you to find a job. So we do think a lot of those people are still unemployed. Some of them are going on to extended benefits, but they're not showing up in those state claims.
Which could be one reason state claims are continuing to go down. One of those extended benefits, the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, or PEUC, part of the CARES Act, provides 13 additional weeks of unemployment insurance once somebody has exhausted their state benefits. Another program called the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, or PUA, expands eligibility to unemployed workers who ordinarily wouldn't qualify for state benefits.
And that's gig workers, self-employed.
Eliza Forsyth teaches economics at the University of Illinois.
There's a whole lot of different people that are eligible through this PUA program that typically are just completely left out of the system.
People can be on PUA for up to 46 weeks in some states until the program's scheduled expiration at the end of the year. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street today in five words or less, keeping with the theme. How about this? Buy, 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 buy. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. It is a truism of this economy about which we remind you often that spending by or on behalf of consumers accounts for nearly 70% of gross domestic product. And so our prospects for economic growth hinge on our ability and our willingness to keep on buying things. Some retailers are getting through the pandemic so far, the ones that sell furniture and home goods, for instance. Some not getting by so well, restaurants and bars in particular, as we have talked about. So with the politics of this economy idling in neutral, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra looked at where consumer spending might go from here.
Left Coast Seafood, a restaurant in Venice, Florida, actually had a decent summer considering the pandemic. The restaurant reopened for sit-down service in May.
The customers were a little bit apprehensive in the beginning, but as people became more comfortable, business picked up.
That's co-owner Mariel Arbuckle-Tarone. Then at the end of September, Florida lifted all restrictions on restaurants. They could open at 100% capacity.
And as soon as that announcement was made, our phone started ringing off the hook.
Customers wanted to know, what was the restaurant going to do?
People told us we're not going to places that are going to be open at 100% that aren't still social distancing. We don't feel comfortable going out.
Left Coast decided for everyone's safety to stay at half capacity, keep its tables spaced out, and continue to require masks for staff. And those phone calls the restaurant got? They're yet another sign that the virus is driving the economy. States or local governments can lift lockdowns, but a lot of people will still be afraid to go to bars and restaurants and movie theaters because they don't want to get sick. Remember that old Bill Clinton campaign slogan?
Rather than it's the economy, stupid, it's COVID-19, stupid.
Lisa D. Cook teaches economics at Michigan State University. And she says as long as COVID-19 is spreading unchecked, we will see a familiar economic pattern, the stop and start.
You know, schools opening and then closing, businesses opening and then closing, football games being scheduled and then being called off. You know, it's running everything.
Now, getting the virus under control, at least until there's an effective, widely available vaccine, does not necessarily require strict, widespread lockdowns. Seth Carpenter, chief U.S. economist for UBS, says the ideal approach for the economy would be more of a middle ground.
So testing, tracing, very narrowly targeted restrictions, mask mandates, those sorts of things allow most, albeit not all, the economic activity to continue while also still trying to restrict the spread of the virus.
Besides the virus, the other thing that'll determine how much consumers spend going forward is fiscal stimulus. But we don't know yet whether this Congress or the next will pass another stimulus bill or what it would look like. Our country and our government are deeply divided, and that makes compromise hard. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
These are important days in the life of this nation, so your public radio station might not be carrying its usual programming. I would argue, though, that these are important days in the life of this economy as well. So if you miss us on the air, do get us on our podcast, would you? You can do that on the app of your choice. Most important meal of the day, right? I mean, turns out not to be entirely true nutrition-wise, but if you're a fast food or a fast casual chain, you go where the money is, and it is with those breakfast customers, or used to be before the pandemic. With more people working from home, though, early day sales are way down, as I said. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains why breakfast is so important and how those chains are trying to get those customers back in the door.
Breakfast is one of those meals that a lot of busy workers, parents, and students do on autopilot, says restaurant consultant Aaron Allen.
When you think of morning, you think of coffee. And for many, Starbucks is a ritual, a daily ritual. But that's changed since COVID.
That's a drag for restaurants, which had been investing more and more in breakfast because coffee and eggs have huge profit margins. And breakfast sells. Usually a third of McDonald's sales come from breakfast alone, says RJ Hadavi at Morningstar.
Restaurants had seen what McDonald's has done. And so I think this was really an area of focus for a lot of companies.
But in the pandemic, McDonald's says breakfast has been its biggest loser. Still, Hadavi says chains are likely to take a gamble that breakfast will bounce back.
I don't think restaurant companies are going to give up on the breakfast category, but I think you're going to start to see more innovations to satisfy changes in consumer behavior.
That might mean adding more bacon, butter, and biscuits to menus, says Lizzie Fryer at Technomic, because it's an emotional time and consumers have been doing some emotional eating.
The reason that people were ordering from restaurants was because of cravings that increased from the first quarter and has continued to increase into the third quarter as well.
Fryer says companies will also have to rethink packaging for delivery because breakfast food can be tricky.
Especially if you have, you know, an over easy egg or something, you know, that's not going to be over easy in 10 minutes.
And that's a challenge when the biggest competition is the eggs already in a customer's fridge. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
All main traffic gets kept to perimeter roads around the superblock.
Ah, yes, the superblock. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 542 points today, 1.9%, closed at 28,390 as Wall Street continued its post-election day rally. Pre-election day rally, too, a couple of days. NASDAQ gained 300 points, up 2.5%, 11,890. The S&P 500 added 67 points, 1.9%, ended things at 35.10. So it turns out not everybody got that automatic $1,200 relief payment from the government. That's from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. They reported 12 million Americans who are eligible might be missing out on those relief checks. Includes a lot of long-term unemployed people, very low-income families, those receiving SNAP benefits as well. No relief bill in sight, as you know. Keeping an eye on some other numbers out there as coronavirus cases climb in a lot of places. Here are some biotech stocks. Novavax up 6.6%. Amgen ticked up 0.7%. Moderna up 2.3% today. Bonds essentially unchanged. Yield on the 10-year Treasury 0.76%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 102,831. That's the number of new COVID cases in this country yesterday, a record, sadly. 14 states had a record number of people hospitalized with the virus. There are some things we've learned by now that make a big difference in reducing the spread of coronavirus. Masks, of course, washing our hands, yes, social distancing, that too. And as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, paid sick leave.
At least 17 European countries, Japan, Australia, and Canada, guarantee some paid sick leave. The U.S. does not, which often means people end up going to work sick, says Ruth Milkman, a labor sociologist at the City University of New York.
People are forced to choose between making a living and protecting their own health and that of their families, and often they choose to make a living.
Which is not great when you're trying to control the spread of a highly contagious virus. So in March, Congress and the White House approved 2 weeks of emergency paid sick leave for COVID-related reasons. In the 38 states that did not already mandate some kind of paid sick leave, a new study shows the law made a big difference.
We saw 400 fewer cases per day.
Nicholas Zebarth is one of the authors of the study and an economist at Cornell. He says the effect of the new law adds up to about 15,000 fewer cases per day.
Because workers in some states could now, for the first time, take paid sick leave.
That's even though the law
essentially left out 106 million workers nationwide.
Pranitha Gupta with the advocacy group, the Center for Law and Social Policy, says the emergency sick leave policy does not apply to companies with more than 500 employees. A lot of smaller companies have been able to get exemptions, and a lot of workers who are covered don't know it. The law will expire at the end of December, and Gupta says if Congress doesn't extend it,
you're going to see the spread of contagion. And as the nation tries to recover and tries to reopen, it'll continue to hamper that reopening and it'll have long-term impacts.
On people's health and well-being, she says, and on the nation's economy. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
As ballots are still being counted, as all legally cast ones should be, by the way, there's a local trend that's becoming pretty clear. This election was a good one for public transit. Yes, those things with wheels, where a bunch of people from different households are crammed together real close, often on the way to offices, which are those places with staplers and copy machines where work used to happen. In most cities, the pandemic has changed a lot about A, how we get around, and B, where we are going. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, there is still a lot of support for funding transit, and transit agencies are going to need it.
San Jose attorney and transit writer Jessica Jenkins watched election results with a lot of anxiety. Voters in three Bay Area counties were deciding on a sales tax increase to rescue Caltrain, the commuter rail service that connects San Francisco with Silicon Valley. Jenkins is visually impaired.
I was really worried. I was like, how am I going to get places? You know, I don't have the option of just buying a car and taking a car.
The tax increase cleared the two-thirds approval needed to pass. In Austin, Texas, business consultant Nathan Ryan is celebrating the passage of a property tax hike to fund a $7 billion expansion of bus and rail.
I think it will mean that Austinites will actually get to experience the city a little bit more and have a little, you know, a little more fun getting around.
Voters from Arkansas to Montana approved 13 transit-related measures worth almost $40 billion. Most are funded by tax increases during a recession and a pandemic that has called into question the very future of cities. Paul Skatelis is the head of the American Public Transit Association.
What has prevailed is a look to the future. Public transit is really at the nexus of many of these challenging issues that we have as a society, from equity, from the environment, and really economic opportunity.
But the pandemic has caused a transit crisis. Ridership has fallen by as much as 90% in some places, while local tax revenues have dwindled. Early in the pandemic, the Federal CARES Act gave transit agencies $25 billion in emergency aid, but Scotella says they'll need another $32 billion with no new relief in sight. That makes local support for transit all the more important, says Yona Freemark at the Urban Institute.
The reality is that the federal government funds just a portion of overall costs of the construction of new transit lines and pays almost nothing when it comes to the operations of transit lines.
He says people who live in cities have become more willing to tax themselves to fund transit. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Speaking of cities, as we just were, a lot of them are looking different now. People are wearing masks. Obviously, outdoor dining has taken over parking spots or roads sometimes, and those roads often have fewer cars on them. But generally speaking, cities are monuments to history, reflections of the way societies were set up when times were different. Jobs were different, transportation was different, and how we thought about gender roles was different, too. There was a story in the Financial Times not too long ago called What Would a City Designed by Women Look Like? Antonia Cundy wrote it, so we called her up to talk about it. Antonia, welcome to the program.
Hi, Guy. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a line from this piece, which will reveal my male privilege, but that's kind of what this story is about. every city in the world, you write, was designed and built by men, which of course, but it's kind of stunning to read that and think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of part of the problem is that when you actually think about it, we are up against such kind of huge historical weight. And Saskia Sassen, this wonderful kind of doyen of urban planning and theory that I spoke to, kind of makes this point that we are lumped with all this enormous amount of stone and concrete, which was designed when there were much more traditional, by which we sort of mean sexist, gender roles and the division of labor. And so, you know, you kind of have to be positive about the small changes that can be made, because that is what we're up against.
Well, so let's talk about some of those changes that are slowly being made by women and people of color and people with disabilities who get into transportation and urban planning roles, because they're happening. It's happening slowly, but it's happening. What kinds of changes do they bring?
So a lot of it kind of focuses on things like decongestion. They are focusing on ideas like super blocks and the 15-minute city, where space is kind of given back to people in a city. So you kind of remove the cars or send them to perimeter roads, for example, in the super blocks.
Yeah. Sorry, explain the super block thing.
Yeah, so the super block, basically groups of streets are clumped together. Essentially, the idea is that all main traffic gets kept to perimeter roads around the super block, so that the inner streets are pedestrianized. They're kind of communal spaces. Yeah, that's how that works.
And then in theory, work and school and kids and home are all more accessible than they are in a lot of these male-designed super cities, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is like a great example of kind of what we're up against, as we say, is that cities were generally designed with financial and business districts being separate from schools or residential areas, because they were designed with these traditional gender roles whereby men got the train to work and women stayed at home and dealt with childcare. And so that's where it actually, what Anne Hidalgo is doing in Paris, where the 15-minute city, which is this idea that all the, your kind of basic needs and amenities, including work, childcare, education, etc., are within a 15-minute walk or cycle. So it's about making that kind of greater accessibility and to make it easier for society to share these roles.
Yeah. Not to end on a downer, but men have been designing cities in our societies for millennia. The pipeline of women in top architecture firms and in transportation and urban design roles is minimal. So this is a long haul here.
Yeah, it is difficult. I mean, I think a lot of the women I spoke to repeated this idea of being the only woman in the room.
Yeah.
And that their ideas about putting community first rather than sort of the economic city first was sort of seen as quite whack and off the wall. but I think, you know, it is getting better. And an exciting thing is that COVID is definitely accelerating these ideas. For example, the 15-minute city fits in with us all working from home. So I think the pandemic will hopefully make progress in this.
Something good coming out of this pandemic. Antonia Cundy, writing in the Financial Times about cities and what maybe a city designed by women might look like. Antonia, thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out, parental leave division. The Fed, as I mentioned up at the top of the program, wrapped up a two-day meeting today of what is technically called the Federal Open Market Committee. And in normal times, when interest rates aren't pegged at basically zero, those meetings are a big deal. The economy, in a lot of ways, depends on them. And to be a voting member of the FOMC helping direct this economy, also a very big deal. Unless you and your wife just had a baby. Minneapolis Fed President Neel Kashkari, a voting member of the FOMC, skipped the meetings because baby number two showed up this week. All right, we are out of here, but here is your Thursday moment of economic context. Come to us from General Motors, which reported earnings this morning, $4 billion in profit July through September. And in October, says Morgan Stanley, for the second month in a row, car sales were back up to where they were before the pandemic hit, which is kind of interesting. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.